What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye!
I remember seeing it in the dictionary. I was reading something. Oh, here it is. Yeah, to pass out of existence.
Welcome to Meep Meep, the Roadrunner podcast, where we go through the albums of Roadrunner Records with the artists who made them and the musicians they influenced. Let's roll. What up, meepsters? And if you're on patreon.com/meepmeeppod, an early edition what up to you, because you're hearing this a day early. That's a new perk of the Patreon. Early access. We'll see how long it lasts, but one thing is for sure, today's episode rocks. The 2001 Roadrunner debut of Ohio's finest, Chimera, and their album Pass Out of Existence. We're joined by mythical Midwest monsters Mark Hunter and Chris Pacuzza for a truly comprehensive rundown of the band in this era, so I'm going to disappear so they can tell the story. So I will start with my kind of history of Chimera, because I remember I had a friend that was super into the This Present Darkness EP. He was just, you know, he was like, Chimera was his favorite band, and I mispronounced it for years because it was always emails that he would send me about this. So Chimera was one of my favorite bands for a long time too, and I remember mail ordering that EP and being super stoked on the title track, This Present Darkness, and Sphere. And then I remember, of course, Farm Club. So I was a huge wrestling fan. I still am. It's one of the most important things in my life. And Farm Club came on after Monday Night Raw, and the chick from the Doritos commercial is on there. And Matt Pinfield is fresh off of telling me to listen to Jimmy's Chicken Shack to tell me about these new bands that are coming that uploaded their songs. So Dead Inside plays, and then Pass Out of Existence comes out. So is Farm Club how you got signed to Roadrunner, or is that just kind of how you were just put on a larger platform that labels became interested?
Interestingly enough, we were already in discussions with them. The brief answer of that is it was basically, you know, having Farm Club under our belt was the icing on the cake that sealed the deal and actually put us into a better position when it came time to actually sign with Roadrunner, because so much positivity had come from it. But the story leading to like how it got into Farm Club's hands is actually, you know, Chris is better suited to tell that.
It all kind of stems back to when I was in high school, with just like most metal guys or metalheads or whatever, you know, you're just obsessed with music and want to be involved in any way as possible because it's so exciting. It's hard to discover bands, you know. And, you know, I discovered that labels were doing this thing called Street Teams, which is now defunct, where they would find fans in all major cities and offer them tickets, rare items, merch, this and that. And in trade, you go to the record stores and you would put up displays. You would see what the stock is of the CD, and you actually felt involved, like you're helping your favorite bands. And so I did that just because I just wanted to be involved. You know, through that, I made a bunch of connections. And so when I finally got with Chimera and we started getting some traction, I believe that This Present Darkness EP was already out. So, you know, I had some leverage to go with that. So when I reached out to some old contacts, I sent them their CMJ reports and all that, and MP3.com stats, and things just started picking up. And one other major piece was a couple of the webzines, and, you know, started covering us as well. One was the PRP.com. I don't remember if it was the Pimp Rock Palace back then. And the owner of the site, his name's Ukubus, who I still talk to basically every day, still to this day. He found out through, I'm guessing, underground talk about, you know, music, and picked up on us. He reviewed our album, gave it a great review, and he started spreading word about us. You know, back then, A&R people used to go to him, you know, for advice, because he was, you know, the leader of the pack of finding new bands. You know, he's a quintessential part of the whole modern, whatever you want to call it, new metal movement. Around 2000, we were in New York doing a showcase, yeah, at the Continental in New York City. And he tipped us off to a woman named Marcy Jacobson, who worked at Geffen at the time, which Geffen was part of Farm Club. And she went to the show and checked us out. She loved it. She loved our energy. And that was it. That's how we got on Farm Club. She liked us so much that she pushed really hard for us to be on the show. And so basically, thanks to those two, that was why we made the show. You know, obviously, like, we put in some good, you know, hard work, and we wrote some good songs, but, you know, that was a big part of that. And what's interesting too is, like, I was trying to think of how I even entered Chimera back in, this was 99. I was just fresh out of high school, and I was in, like, community college, and I was in a band that I played bass in, and we actually practiced next door to the original version of Chimera. And the singer of my band actually went to high school with a lot of the Chimera guys, and the singer of my band's brother was in a band with Mark back in when they were in high school. So there's all these strange connections, and we used to hang out all the time because we were literally practicing next door to each other in this warehouse.
They had the best room. Like, we were in there, we had just, you know, music gear and some boxes. And then we went over their room. They had, like, TVs, VCR, pornos, fucking, you know, all these cool shit. We're like, man, we got to step it up and make our practice space that cool.
Oh, we were so horrible though. Like, I don't think we even had a tuner, like, in the practice space. It was so bad. It was just an excuse to hang out, and we played music that sounded like Korn meets Mr. Bungle, but a really horrible version of that. And we would barely practice, like he said. You'd hear us play like three songs, and then we would just watch Gummo or some movie, you know, you know, for the rest of the day. But it was awesome. It was what I did in high school. It was fun. It was my release from, you know, school life. And because of that, I met the Chimera guys. But I don't recall why they chose me to be in the band or asked. I do recall Mark and I believe he asked me to be in a band at like Pizza Hut or something like that.
Yeah, that's probably true. My recollection of is a little hazy as well, but I just remember being a fan of, you know, my musical tastes, besides hardcore metal, are also industrial. And so I was always hoping to have like an extra element in our sound. With Present Darkness, we were trying to make like a few sounds, and I was doing them with my mouth or with guitar effects, or maybe Ben Shiggle had a keyboard with him at the studio that we could make some sounds, but we always were trying to like slowly integrate this into the music. And especially like in I'd say 99, 2000, I guess you're starting to see more of that too, right? Bands are getting DJs or keyboardists are showing up or samplers, whatever. And so I just recall like wanting to get Chris in the band somehow. We were like, we became friends. And I remember asking Rob, like, hey man, you gotta listen to like some Nine Inch Nails, and he can't stand that kind of music. So it's like, you know, I'm not doing a good job being a salesman, but for some reason he still thought it was a good idea as well. And, you know, I remember asking Chris, but you were there with us while we were recording Present Darkness. You were hanging out
yeah.
in the studio. And I remember that much. And I think it was only a matter of time before we figured out how to get you into the band.
And I do remember that, you know, at that time, Fear Factory was huge, and they had that extra element, that industrial sound. And that was a huge attraction to you guys and me, of course, as well. And obviously Slipknot's first record came out, and that exploded. And that was so exciting. And I was so drawn to that because, you know, the stuff my band was doing was not at the level of intensity that I wanted out of music. And so naturally, like when they said, would you want to do this kind of, you know, electronic thing? I was like, absolutely. You know, I could figure it out. I'm just that guy with like born computer intuition. I had no experience going into it. There was a computer program back then called Acid Pro or something like that, where you're just taking like waveforms and dropping them on a timeline. And I would just make songs. And, you know, I was kind of toying around with that up until, you know, he actually asked. So when he offered, I was like, yeah, I could probably figure it out. You know, I'm making these goofy songs myself at home. Why not?
So, Mark, going back to This Present Darkness, who is doing all those echo scratch that you're just making noises with your mouth?
There's some that I did with guitar, and then there's some I did with my mouth, and then there's a few things we did with some keyboards. If you listen to my original band on Spotify, too, before Camaro, there's a band called Skipline, and I think it was the title track of our album. I do all this weird shit on my guitar. I just liked scratching and making pick noises and weird things like that. You put it through a bunch of effect pedals and you could kind of make samples that way. It was a very primitive way of kind of combining like influences of like, I guess, a Tom Morello, you know, with, hey, we don't have any keyboards in our band. We're Rage Against the Machine. All these sounds come from a guitar, but also liking, you know, non-conventional instruments. I love Nine Inch Nails or, you know, the guys making sounds with a straw in Downward Spiral. So
not long after Pass Out of Existence comes out, I was working at a studio in Boca Raton, Florida, and one Bradley Kochschmidt gave me a Skipline CD of a song just called Down. It's one song. And I don't know if he was in Skipline or just around it, but I still have that CD somewhere.
Holy shit. So Brad joined the band at the tail end of our tenure, if you will. And the band broke up because our first out-of-town show, we got all of our equipment stolen. And we had to hitchhike back home from Rhode Island. But Brad was in the band towards the later end. And I was actually the guitarist of Skipline. And then I moved over to vocals because we started writing heavier tunes. And our vocalist, we started writing more like, I guess you could call it metalcore, or what we, you know, Camaro would eventually become. Whereas our vocalist was very tailored for hardcore. And we kind of started out with hardcore and like throwing like a couple breakdowns. So he worked out perfect for that. But once we started incorporating more metal, the riffs had to get more complex. And then I became the vocalist. And that's when Brad jumped in. And he's probably in the band for maybe like 6 months. You know, the band didn't even last that long to begin with. So, but I remember meeting Brad and we were introduced. You know, I was a drummer, young drummer, and I know I just said I was a guitarist, but hey, before that I was a drummer. I was a young drummer and he was a guitarist and I was excited to meet him and like maybe start a band with him. So, you know, mutual friend hooked us up and we went over to Ben's place because Ben had a studio and we're like, all right, I can play on the Ben's drums and meet this Brad guy and see if we have a connection musically. Dude, Brad was so much more advanced than me as a musician that I just basically looked at Ben and like handed him the sticks and like, hey man, this dude's yours. Like that, like Brad's like fucking, you know, Yngwie Malmsteen at age 16.
For the people that might not know who we're talking about, you know, in Skipline, the lineup was Mark, Jim LaMarca, he's bass, Ben Schigel did what, drums? Yeah, Ben Schigel on drums. And if you recall, Ben Schigel produced many of our records and he was in the band Switched and I think a few others. But and then Brad Kochschmidt, I didn't even know he was in the band. He was in Switched as well. And then he was in Nonpoint for the longest time. So there's so many ties.
There was like he played a show with us, too. It was him and Ed Gandalf became Skipline guitarists and I became the vocalist. And we played a couple shows and fizzled out.
Really? It's kind of wild how Strongsville, Ohio had this little network of people that were in the creative sphere that just did so well. And then Todd Bell, he directed all of our DVDs and films and music videos. He ended up moving out to California. You know, he went to high school with all those guys as well. He went out to California, went to film school. I think that's where he went. And he always was an integral part of Chimera and our vision. another guy, Garrett Zunt, who helped with a lot of our artwork as well. We had this network of friends that we trusted, and everyone understood each other. We're all cut from the same cloth, and it was just really cool.
Another cool connection from Strongsville is Matt Warburton. He wrote for The Simpsons and also for Community. He was like 1 year below me. And weirdly enough, I just met some client. She's like, oh, my daughter works at Geffen Records for 20 years. What? Why does everyone in Strongsville have like a music industry connection?
When I first was asked to be in the band and they were recording This Present Darkness, I believe that's when we started transitioning me into practicing with the band. And I had no idea how to perform this stuff live. I had no equipment to do so. I wasn't about to bring my giant PC down to the practice space. Mark knew the singer of Integrity, Dwid, and Dwid was very much into electronic music as well, as kind of one of his side things. And so he talked to him about, you know, showing me what he has and his gear wise and kind of showing me the ropes. And I remember, yeah, my first piece of gear I bought was a Roland 808 SP, I think it was called. And yeah, just because Dwid showed it to me, I was like, oh, this is perfect. You know, you load a bunch of waveforms onto a zip disk, you put it in this drive and you have buttons glowing, tells you what to hit and you could add effects. And it was really cool. And I think it had like a theremin thing going too, maybe.
Yeah, you would put your hand over the...
Yeah, so on the top, there was like this motion sensor theremin type sound and you know, which made it, you know, it was another cool perk to having it. And I remember, you know, going to Guitar Center, buying a bunch of sample CDs because, you know, I had no gear to even make samples. I would go home and just load them into the programs I have, and I would just mess with effects and pitch shift them and make them unique. And that's how I came across the Dead Inside sample. And I can't remember what the original source was, but you know, it was distorted and pitched, and I just dumped it onto the zip drive, brought it to practice, and I just started playing it one day. And this was one of my first practices too, I believe. And I had my samples running through my bass drive, and it just didn't sound good, but it worked. And I think it was Jason Hager started just riffing the opening riff of Dead Inside over it. And the song was basically written in that first practice or first or second practice I was in. It was kind of wild how just bringing in one element spawned, you know, a new level of creativity.
And a huge song for the band. I mean, I know that one you guys shied away from after the second album comes out, but
that's the song we play on Farm Club. That seals the deal. It becomes, you know, a fan favorite. And
T-shirt.
T-shirt. I can't believe we never did a video for that one. It's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. I think in regards to shying away from it, you know, I'm sure I have to have a lot to do with it. And my issues with the song are mostly that it just shows the immaturity of, like, my sound in that time, or, you know, because I evolved over time. And you know, I was still trying to figure out how is even going to fit what I was doing into Chimera without taking away from what they already had going on, but also not straight up ripping off Slipknot or Fear Factory. You know, I would have loved to do more industrial stuff, but I knew that I couldn't do it. At least at the time, I didn't know how to do it without sounding like straight up ripping off Fear Factory, because we already had similar riffage as Fear Factory.
How does Mudrock get involved in being the producer?
Through our A&R, Kevin Estrada. Kevin had a band called Anyone. Since you're a Roadrunner connoisseur, you might even be familiar with that album.
Intimately.
And he, Mudrock produced that album. And while Kevin was in the studio with Mudrock, he played our demos, presumably Dead Inside and things of that nature. I think it was Dead Inside. And Mudrock just fell in love with it. He was like, man, this is really cool. I really like it. I really want to produce this band. And we had always envisioned Dino from Fear Factory producing our record. And that was kind of a weird, I guess, piece of Chimera trivia not too many people know about, but, you know, he was our first thought. Of course, he got busy with what would have been Digimortal, and it took us a long time to get signed anyway. So when we had heard that Mudrock was so enthusiastic about producing us, you know, we had never thought of Mudrock because, you know,
you weren't a big Power Man 5000 fan at the time.
Even that, but it was, you know, we're thinking this guy does Godsmack. So it was kind of almost like, whoa, you know, I remember feeling like it was a big deal that he wanted to work with us just because he had, you know, done such a massive album under his belt and didn't really need to work with a band of our caliber, if you will. And I remember really enjoying the Godsmack guitar tones and thinking their albums just sound really big.
I believe there was like an influence at the time too, where Roadrunner was trying to welcome in more radio friendly metal albums,
right?
Like not so much making you sell out, but making something accessible so they could, you know, move more records. Cause it was, you know, worked well for Fear Factory. They made it known that we'd have a better push if we offered some stuff up. I think we were just excited because it was, you know, we were being pushed into the big leagues, and this is an era where it was big money labels and they're just throwing it around, and we got caught up in the moment, and it was exciting, you know, like to feel like we're part of the Roadrunner roster, you know, the bands that we all looked up to. You know, we had like a small bunch of songs, but I don't feel like they were like fully developed, because, you know, a lot of times, like most bands, their first record, they have so much time to work on those songs. I feel like half our songs on that record were done like just months before we went to record, you know, or somewhat done.
We had a weird issue with us as well, that the stipulation on our contract requires for a specific amount of songs. And that's, you know, not to get too boring, but it's under the mechanical royalty. And we wound up, you know, having to repurpose a couple EP songs because of that. Yeah, pretty underprepared and having to flesh out ideas. And we spent about a week in pre-production fleshing those ideas out. We were like in Mate's studio, and that's where we were preparing click tracks for the album, and then kind of repurposing, like that's how we discovered Sphere, you know, and the whole like slowing it down at the ending. That's a big change from the EP version. And I think Obeo, I was making that joke when I was like, yeah, this is before I did drugs. But the song was there because we needed an extra song.
Yeah.
That's how underprepared we were. And we had to fill this quota of 14 songs. It's like, we don't have another song. So here's this thing.
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
So Mates, for who, like people that don't know, it's a rehearsal studio, I think at Burbank, somewhere in Southern California, Los Angeles area. And it's used for pre-production on albums. It's used for live pre-production. And it's just a series of studios in like this warehouse complex. And we rented out one for 2 weeks and worked with Mudrock, you know, just going over every song, because you obviously don't want to be making these changes in the studio, especially as a new band. You know, the cost of Mates is probably half of the cost of, you know, being in the studio every day working on stuff. And it was also a good time to just get familiar and comfortable with Mudrock. And I don't remember if he had an engineer in there or not. Some cool things that happened at Mates. Motorhead was renting out the studio next door. And a couple of the guys would always hang out with us. Mickey D, the drummer, because there's like a, you know, like a lounge area with a pinball machine. And, you know, when you want to take a break and do whatever, your options were either walk around the parking lot or go to this lounge area. And so we would hang out with Mickey D. I believe Todd Youth played guitar for Danzig. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was always hanging out with us as well. And, you know, and then one day they're like, hey, you guys want to watch Motorhead practice? And half of us were like, fuck yeah, you know, like, so one of my memories is just me and I think it was Mark and Jim hanging out with Motorhead while they make us go deaf. It was the loudest thing ever. It was just every amp cranked the loudest volume and, you know, got to hear about six songs. It was sick. It was such a wild time for us, just dudes from Cleveland, to just be dropped into this artificial Hollywood world and trying to mingle with these people when you're cut from a different cloth and you just don't act and think the same way as everyone else and just trying to fit in. It was such a strange time. And we're hanging out at the Rainbow Bar and Grill overnight, going broke, spending our money on, you know, $12 Red Bull and vodkas. You know, I was 19 and they were serving me. So Yeah, it was a wild time. You know, our manager, actually, who was our manager at the time? Was Scott our manager?
We had a mix. We started off managed by Tom Hazard, and then we eventually moved over with Scott Koenig and King Artist Management. And I want to say during the Roadrunner era, right in that beginning time, they were still kind of working together, but Scott was if I remember correctly anyway, he was, you know, gearing to be more and more towards our main guy by that point.
Yeah, Scott also managed Fear Factory, Spine Shank, just to give you some background on
Biohazard, Downside. Yeah.
And he was kind of known as the mayor of the Rainbow. And so you'd go hang out with them, and because you're sitting with them, you'd get to meet everyone else because they'd all come up to talk to with them. You know, the Rainbow every night, you'd see Be Real and his crew all smoking right on the front patio. Stefan from Deftones was all often hanging out with them. And, you know, through going to the Rainbow, you know, we got to be more friendly with Stefan. He somehow discovered our EP, and we sent him a shirt. We found out he loved the band, and he wore it during a Rock and Reel performance, which is really cool, which is one of those multicast performances. So you got to see us, you know, on TV him on TV wearing our shirt, which is, I mean, as a massive Deftones fan, that was just like, oh my. Tom Hazard, he was one of the main people I gave my stuff to. And I met him because he was living in Sandusky, Ohio. It was really strange. I met him at a Peabody show. It was at Cold Chamber opened, and that's why I went. It was off, just the first record just came out. Cold Chamber opened for like Grip Incorporated and Bloodlet. It was such a weird show.
Bloodlet.
Yeah, it was a cool show, but it was weird. And since I was like not exposed to a lot of those bands, you know, I have no idea what was going on. You know, I was so caught up in the Roadrunner new metal thing as well. You know, like I was a big Korn fan, you know, throughout high school. That was like my band, you know, Deftones. But yeah, that's how I met Tom. And then Tom was a big advocate for us in LA. So he was integral to getting us to basically put us in the right hands, you know.
I didn't know that Kevin Estrada was your A&R. I think I always thought Monty Connor was. So that's interesting that Kevin Estrada was like, I got to get out, pass out of existence, and I got to get out, pin the tail on the honky in the same year.
Right. So what's funny is Monty thought we were basically great value Korn. We were worthy to be signed. But Kevin really believed in us and pushed for us. Then all of a sudden, you know, more and more things started happening positively for the band. Finally, you know, Monty came in to our showcase in New York City, the same one that Chris was mentioning earlier that Marcy from Farm Club went to. Monty was there as well. So was Jose from Sirius. He was a young...
Mangan?
Yes, Jose Mangan. He was a young television personality for... Was it TVT Records? They were doing some sort of promo thing, and he was outside of the Continental. That was the first time we met him. So that was a very, you know, important night. But no, yeah, Monty was basically like, you guys are fucking great value Korn, pass.
The other thing that's very interesting to me is you mentioned wanting Dino to produce the album, because especially re-listening to it recently, but even then, you know, it seems like very much like level two of
demanufacture,
not only because of the sound, but you know, the album cover, the colors that are used, the way it has that mechanical looking bug, which maybe Chris, you can talk to me more about the artwork for it. But I always thought that it seemed like, you know, not an imitation or a knockoff of Fear Factory, but certainly heavily influenced. And I'm sure having an electronics member didn't hurt that influence in my mind.
For sure. When it came to the creative stuff with the band, for whatever reason, Mark and I always took the lead on that. We were the ones that always had the ideas. The other guys just wanted to focus on music. That was where they were most comfortable. And I loved, you know, all things art and anything to do with working on a computer. You know, it was my thing. And I don't remember who exactly did the artwork.
Neil Allardy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. So this is a guy from Scotland who I think we got hooked up through Roadrunner. They just suggested someone, maybe. You know, his name is Neil Allardyce, and he ended up doing our websites for a while, and he became a buddy of mine, and he did like two or three of our websites, but he only helped with the first record artwork. And I believe we just wanted something very techy because we knew the sound of the record had a very, I guess, sci-fi sound in regards to the sampling, you know, and I don't know how that even happens, but it had a very futuristic sound, and we wanted to reflect that. I don't know if that artwork really gives the right vibe to the record or the band. It kind of just happened, you know, and we just like, okay, this is cool, we'll take it, you know. I don't recall us getting super involved like we did later on, you know, in regards to artwork. Like the first record was definitely one where Roadrunner had more hands in it.
I remember my only recollection of it was really not having much input, like you said, but getting the material back and being like, whoa, we've never really seen much like that before, because man, you got to go back again 20 years and, you know, almost seeing like a 3D rendering on a Photoshop is almost, you know, new to dudes like us. And like, I've never seen anything like that, man.
I remember it being kind of similar to Chaos Fear by Meshuggah, their record cover. And I was like, that's really cool. And, you know, not as evil as theirs, but, you know, it was that same kind of like futuristic violent vibe, you know, to it. Yeah, that was mostly it. I don't recall the direction or giving them direction or anything like that. I think it just happened, you know?
Reminds me of Phantasm, the horror movie. That's always been my...
Well, I know that This Present Darkness has a little bit of singing on a few songs. Lend a Hand has singing on it. Is that you singing on Lend a Hand?
Actually, Ben Schigel. Interesting.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But what was, you kind of referenced earlier that, you know, Roadrunner was kind of looking for a more commercial sound, certainly not just a full-blown pop band or anything like that. But what was one of the first songs for Pass Out of Existence that you remembered writing like a full-on, like, sung chorus for?
Taste Mine. And that's kind of where we actually met Mushroom Head. So yeah, Taste Mine would have been at least first one I remember like really trying to record and demo, and that also is the introduction of Jim LaMarca to the band. And one of the first songs we wrote with him, and we went to record those demos at a location, a studio named Mars, and that's an infamous recording studio. They did Integrity, they did the Earth Crisis Firestorm, they did all the Mushroom Head records. And they recorded the big attraction besides being a legendary studio in Cleveland was they recorded with Analog. And we wanted to try that. I know for certain that we did Taste Mine. But it was funny because Jim was hanging out in the studio and he had a Slipknot sticker on his bass. And the Mushroom Head drummer came in and there was just like that really weird, awkward moment because that was pretty much the height of their beef.
You know what? That's probably what led to some of the negativity between the two bands, because obviously we're going to side with Slipknot because we were friends with the guys and Roadrunner affiliation. So I think that's where that came from too. So, yeah. But yeah, I remember that. And I actually remember tracking, and because it was Analog, it was so awkward. I have to just plug my sampler in and make sure it's in time with it. It was so weird. I don't even know if we recorded to a click track. I remember it being very difficult to record those samples, and it was not fun. It was not Pro Tools, that's for sure, at least the tracking part.
We also did demos at Morris Sound during Resurrection, which is not to jump way too ahead, but that's another legendary studio, which I have no idea where those demos are either, and I would love to get my hands on both.
Yeah, that's Roadrunner as hell to do Morris Sound. That's all those like Obituary and Deicide, and I mean, you know what it is, so I don't have to tell you. But
I remember the moment where we got you to start doing clean vocals, because we wanted to, a lot of guys wanted to incorporate that, but we just didn't know if you could even sing, so you never sang. It was always like when we would do Lend a Hand live or whatever, you would scream or just not do the chorus or that part from what I remember at first. And then eventually you started singing it. And then we started kind of like pushing you to go in that direction as well, or at least to give it a shot, you know? It was kind of cool to see how that came too.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing, but that was, I mean, it was conscious, you know, as well, because we were also fans of heavy bands that utilized clean vocals. It wasn't just like, hey, man, we need to make some accessible shit. But like, man, Mudvayne was another influence. They had like songs like Death Blooms, where it's like, this shit's heavy as fuck, but it's also melodic and nice and, you know.
Machine Head, obviously.
Yeah. So I think.
Fear Factory.
Exactly. In addition to having a bit of pressure of, hey, you know, you want to sell records, it's also like, hey, you know, we're also a fan of this style of music as well.
So the album opens with Let Go, which I think is a really good representation of the album. It kind of has everything that the band does on this album in one song. Interestingly enough too, I noticed that it seems to be the only song with like a guitar solo, like a full-on solo. So is that a conscious thing to not include? It seems like somebody like Rob, who I'm pretty sure has never played a wrong note in his life, would not want to keep guitar solos out of it. But was that something that was intentional?
It's the era. We weren't writing music with guitar solos, and it just wasn't a thing. I mean, again, Rob also is a metalhead at heart, but was coming from the hardcore scene. And you just don't hear guitar solos in the hardcore scene, right? You're just, it's like intro, verse, chorus, bridge, breakdown, you know?
For sure, yeah. That metalcore era, coming off of This Present Darkness and that whole, like, you know, obviously, like, bands like Hatebreed, they weren't doing solos back then either. And we were, you know, they were definitely in that vibe, you know, that This Present Darkness. And yeah, just like you said, like, it just wasn't a thing then, you know? It wasn't that Rob didn't want them. It was just that we weren't, what we're doing.
Yeah, they didn't call for them. We didn't write music with solos in mind, things of that nature.
But it wasn't like a thing where he was like, hey, can I put a solo on here? And you guys were like, no.
Oh, never, no.
Okay. Severed seems to be the song that stuck around in the set for the longest, probably even to the end. So what about this song are you guys so fond of?
I don't know if it's that we're fond of it. I think the fans are fond of it, right? And it's a highly requested song. It's one that when you're a front man and you want to command the crowd, I mean, it's perfectly set up for me to be like, all right, here's where you're going to jump. Here's where you're going to kill each other. Here's where you're going to sing along. It's one simple fucking word. It's really tailor-made for the live experience, especially for... when we would, it's a shorter song, so when we would play and open for new acts, it was an easy song for us to win the crowd over with.
Chris, you feel the same way about this song as not the front man?
I got worn out on it real quick, you know, as we progressed and things got more intricate, and a lot of my issues with any song is usually my input on the song, and Severed was something where there wasn't a lot of input for me. You know, all I really did was a couple little sounds on the verses, and then I would help on vocals live, and then there was that breakdown part, you know. So playing it live was just kind of unchallenging and boring to me. You know, it's a fun mosh song. Obviously, the crowd loves it. But yeah, it's just something that didn't sit well with me over time, but it all reflects on just me being self-aware and or not self-deprecating and...
What's funny for me about this song is that I used to really like it, but then I started to be spiteful towards it, because when I would go see Chimera and that would be the only song off this album you guys would play, it made me like hate it. I'm like, oh, it's this one. They're not going to give me what I want. They're going to give me Severed instead again.
While we're in Pass Out era, if you look at it from a distance, we were put through the ringer mentally. You know, we're jumped into, hey, go make an album. Whoa. And then you're all excited for the album to come out and you're ready. And then there's this huge delay and we're then on tour for a whole bunch and we're out promoting an album that's not even going to come out. And then we're spending all of our money and it's just, then the record comes out and it doesn't doing well.
And 9/11.
Fuck, 9/11 comes and we're like, you know what? It's time to fucking hit the boomer reset button, turn it off and then turn it back on again, brother.
That's yeah. Near the end of, you know, while we're on that cycle too, was at the same time the beginning of the exile of nu metal and that whole sound of having heavy samples, sometimes DJs, that was looked down upon, and musicianship was ushered in solos and thrash riffs and Swedish riffs, and that became the cool thing. And, you know, those bands were already influences of all my band members. Well, not my band, you know, of the Chimera guys. So it wasn't like, we're like, oh, we want to sound like this. It was already in there, you know, like Rob's main influences are like Cannibal Corpse and Deicide. So that was already in his DNA. But, you know, as we went on, you know, Press was just crushing nu metal bands. And obviously that put pressure on us, because Roadrunner wanted us to have longevity. And so in order to do that, you know, they definitely influenced the record after, which was a pretty big blow to me. And I don't know how deeply you want to get into it at this point, but like, you know, my presence on that record is very little because of the pressure from Roadrunner.
It was difficult. You know, Chris is totally right that the nu metal exodus was happening. And we were also kind of frustrated by that. While we enjoyed nu metal music and we definitely had influences of nu metal, we also came from the school of hardcore, the school of death metal, the school of industrial. So it wasn't just being lumped into that category was annoying. And so we were like, let's do our own category. And that's where the, you know, the new wave of American heavy metal phrase comes from. And the cognizant decision to change, to get more back to our roots of, you know, yeah, I like Korn, but I wasn't listening to Korn when I was 8. I was listening to Slayer. So let's get back to shit, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The Slayer tour was definitely a pivotal point for us in our, and seeing, you know, us all being huge fans and then seeing how they do things, and it just rubbed off on us. And I know Rob wanted to step up into a lead guitar role, and he crushed it. Then also Matt DeVries was a new element to the band. You know, Matt came in right after the record was released, you know, replaced Jason, and instantly Matt brought an entirely new influence, you know. So that's where the Chimera sound definitely shifted more towards death metal thrash riffs.
But yeah, there's you know, the single stringed, but we still kept that around too, man. Like a song like Six, the chorus of that is, that's as fucking pass out as it can get. It's just not as detuned, right? So that's the biggest change, is the tuning from the low A, drop G tunings of Pass Out to the drop C, higher tuned songs. They sound more metallic. They sound more thrashy. They're automatically going to sound less nu metal-ish.
So I worked with this guy. So to go back to Pass Out, I worked with this guy named Justin Walden. He was the engineer on a record, or he was the guy, he was brought in so with Pro Tools, you know, you often need someone to edit all the drums and stuff to just make sure they're perfectly on the grid so that you can make edits throughout the song without problems and, or with ease or whatever. And Justin, he was known for, he worked on Seven Dust Home, that record. He worked on Korn Follow the Leader, and a few others. He was an interesting cat, and he had tons of chops. He was just like a local Hollywood musician who had his own band, but then on the side, he programmed drums, you know, to make a living. And he helped me a lot on Pass Out with samples, like the end of Sphere. I think there's like a keyboardish outro. He helped me with that. I didn't have the gear to do that. He brought up in all his own stuff, showed me how it worked, and that's how that came about.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of the effects came from guitar. Like, we were still doing what we had brought over from Present Darkness a little bit into the Pass Out, but I don't think we ever did that kind of stuff again after that. Like, you were, by impossibility, you're already like, all the sounds are coming from you from that point on.
Yeah. Impossibility, moving forward from Impossibility, was all on me. I did obviously have help, and I love collaborating because that's how I learn new things. That was kind of a thing that always stuck with me. I always felt like I was the guy who didn't belong on tour because I was around such talented dudes, you know, and I was just some dude figuring it out. And, you know, where I excelled was on the creative side with Chimera, you know, all things you would see between stage production, websites, artwork, you know, the presentation of the band, you know, our branding, you know, that's where I excelled. And it was cool that I was in a band where they respected me being a guy that was learning on the job at all times.
Well, I think, to be fair, from how early on Chimera became a signed band, you all are kind of learning on the job. You're all developing and processing. Sure. You're all so young. I know you're the youngest, but, you know, Mark even said he's not significantly older than you, that you're all developing as human beings and as a band. So I wouldn't say that you should take all of that that weight on yourself. It seems like the band as a whole, so much so that there's member changes almost immediately after.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's just one of those things where I was always hard on myself because I wanted to be the best at what I did. And that's all it was just pushing myself. And, you know, I was sensitive to that. And, you know, I would hear comments here and there down the road, like when we're on tour, like, because, you know, live, you know, I'm just triggering samples. And later on, I brought in keyboards and stuff, but it still wasn't like Children Bodom dude ripping solos on the keyboard. So, you know, I'd hear comments and remarks here and there, and it sucked to hear that, but it's just like, you know, one of those things that you deal with, you know. I think I brought a unique element to the band.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. I think that definitely set Chimera apart, especially early on, especially with this album. So I am grateful for your contribution to it, because I'm sure I wouldn't have been as interested in Even just seeing the video for Split, which we can go ahead and talk about now, Split being the single, you know, the visual of having that, you kind of brought it up earlier, that sixth member, whether it's a DJ, a keyboard player, a sampler, that immediately, especially at that time, attracted me. I was like, okay, so this band isn't just two guitars, bass, drums, and vocals. It has something new, because I've got plenty of bands that are that. You know, I want that new thing to excite me. So I feel like your presence on it, and also, this is maybe just me making stuff up, but in my mind, you were always kind of like a producer of the band as well. I know maybe Shiggle, he becomes like officially the producer on the next record, but I always kind of saw you as that role. And maybe that's just me projecting, because you're doing the electronics. So I'm like, oh, he must also be producing, you know, like, but.
I could see where that could be your thought, because samples were, and the electronic sound was so heavy on Pass Out. I definitely was never a producer, but I was lucky to work with people so welcoming and so willing to collaborate. You know, Mark and Rob always were the guys leading the charge on our records and our sounds. And obviously whoever was actually producing it, you know, we always made sure to choose someone that would work well with us. And we wanted someone that could contribute. I always felt comfortable with getting their ideas and trying to take it to another place, instead of like, hey guys, here's this thing I did, let's write a song around it, which I know they would have done or tried, but you know, it only worked out with, I think, Dead Inside and maybe one or two other songs where I came up with something and a song was born. But I liked having the canvas to paint on. It was fun.
Pass Out of Existence is the name of the record and the name of the song. So Where does that title come from, and why was that the song that you chose to name the record after, or is it the other way around?
I remember seeing it in the dictionary. I was reading something. Oh, here it is. Yeah. To pass out of existence. I was, oh, that sounds cool. I don't remember why, but I just saw that phrase and I thought it was cool. But it's the definition of the word disappear. The title, it just fit, right? So the syllables fit. I don't remember which came first, the chicken or the egg. It just fit in that song. I felt that phrase. It worked. I probably had the phrase first, and then I dropped it in. Like, it just, you know, fit like a glove, if you will. It's kind of like sometimes a lot of phrases just, if you're scatting over the song or whatever, and like, oh, I Hate Everyone was the same thing. It just came out, and it was almost by accident. So it's possible it happened that way. I don't really truly recall other than where it came from.
I was super proud of that track, because it was the first time I got to really do some industrial stuff with Ministry type sampling on it. And of course, Andles ruined the main sample for me. That's throughout the verse. He would mimic it with his mouth at practice and make fun of it. He made it sound like Pac-Man or something, and just destroyed it for me. And but yeah, that was a cool track, and that was one of the first times I was able to showcase, like, yeah, my Ministry, Nine Inch Nails type influence. I believe that track was all me. I don't remember getting much help on that one.
My favorite thing about that song is it starts off with that main riff, but the tempo of it is almost like an 80s song, you know, the drums like are like a little bit more upbeat, and it never comes back to that beat, but it deceives you like it's about to be a happy song, but in fact it's not. That would be the next song,
right?
Abeo, which is Latin for to bring joy.
Yeah,
and what a joyous track it is.
Latin, to depart, to go away, to transform, to metamorphosize, to pass.
Look at Ryan trying to be all positive, and then the truth.
Yeah, I was trying to bring some light to this dreary.
No, man, it's to fucking. No, can you swear on this channel? The disappearing. You know, whole
you can swear, but you can't say the C word. So we'll get to that in a second.
Chimera.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the lyrical content, there's always you could tell Mark's releasing demons, and it's never joyous vibes.
So yeah, Split is the single, and an interesting thing about the lyrics for that is because the album in general doesn't really have a whole lot of profanity, but you've got the C word on here, which is, at the time, I remember, maybe things have changed because of BBC, but you couldn't, that was like the worst word you could say.
I remember.
And you said it, you son of a bitch.
I felt like saying it. So now that song interestingly came about from by that point. So Split was a newer song of ours. And like Chris mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, we were unprepared and I didn't have vocals for that song. So that was one of the ones that I was unprepared with. And by this point, I'm out of ideas. I'm out of gas. I'm out of everything. And I believe Mudrock was telling me a story of some situation he was in with a relationship. And that's where I drew the influence from. I was like, yeah. And then like, it just worked, you know, again, one of those, that word just came out, it landed in phonetically and in the pocket and in the song. And, but yeah, not a personal song for me. And people wonder about that. Like, man, who's the bitch that got that ask Mudrock that song. That's his, from what I remember anyway.
I kind of remember the birth of that song too. I think we wrote the main riff right before leaving to do that small. So we did it in January of 2000, or was it 2001? We did a small run with Spine Shank, and they happened to come through town. And at the time we were already working with Scott Koenig or in talks with him. And so he, you know, told his band, cause he was managing him as well, to check us out and, or have us open up the show. And we got along so well with those guys. They were just having local openers open up their tours, just Spine Shank and Nonpoint. And we're like, can we come? You know, we've never done a tour. And they're like, sure, why not? You know, they liked us. And it literally just like that, we're meeting up with them a couple of days later. And, we toured in Matt DeVries's, he wasn't even in the band at the time, but he drove with us, his Chevy Blazer with a U-Haul attached to it. And then, our drum tech at the time, or if you want to call him that, his name is Jay. We drove in his car. It was like an old Impala or something like that. And that's how we got to all the shows. And we shared one or two hotel rooms. We had absolutely no money. I don't think we made more than $100 per show, but we didn't care. It's just like, holy shit, we're on tour with a major label band. And they were such cool guys. And they kind of just took us under their wing for a good year or two. And, but I remember jamming Split during soundcheck at, it was like, I think it was Chattanooga, Tennessee. I don't know why I remember this, but I can picture the stage and everything. And Jay, our drum tech, was Rob busted out the riff and Jay just started playing the song. And I think we wrote the chorus and verse during just rehearsal, you know, like soundcheck or whatever. And we just kept jamming because it was such a fun, bouncy riff to play. And yeah, that's where it all started.
Was there ever any other song in consideration for being the single?
I don't recall Roadrunner even considering singles with us on that record.
Yeah.
I remember the band expecting more out of Roadrunner on that cycle. I think the delays plus the 9/11, I don't know if I'm just making excuses, but it feels like it definitely took a toll on a release. Like Roadrunner seemed to be a label where they would put X amount of effort into your initial release. And if it doesn't do enough on its own, or you get enough traction, they kind of just move on to the next, because they have so many releases and so many bands that they want to try to break whatever new band they have or whatever major release. And, you know, our record came out the exact same time as El Nino's first one. And, you know, they got a lot of steam right away. And so we were kind of not competing, but we're, you know, at the same time, you know, between Roadrunner fighting for coverage, you know. And then Digimortal came out and so did Supercharger all at the same time. And so I feel like we got lost in that mix for sure. And because the record didn't come out the gate doing crazy numbers, you know, like I remember us expecting crazy first week sales because we had so much traction, but then we found out they only shipped like 15,000 records. You're like, oh, well, we're capped right there because there's only gonna be one or two copies in your small record shops, you know. And I think we ended up doing like 4,200 copies and we're disappointed, but it was a great feat for a new band, you know.
What were the delays that you keep talking about?
So yeah, that's a good question because people don't realize that Roadrunner in that era sold a majority of their company to Island Def Jam, and they had to postpone our release because of this merger that they were doing. And during this entire merger and postponement, our record was supposed to come out in like June of 2002 or something, and it didn't wind up coming out until October. And that whole time frame, we were on tour promoting it, and it's like, just, the album's not coming out for months. So not only were we like promoting, you know, nothing to sell, but to do these tours, we're taking tour support from Roadrunner. And tour support at the time, hey, you know, the band's got to go out for a month and they're getting paid $200 a show. And just for them to be able to do it, they're going to need an extra $50,000, you know, just for them to get from point A to point B. So Roadrunner would, you know, loan the band this money to go on tour. And the hope is, you know, the record is successful and then it's paid back. But because of the delay and because of the merger, now we're burning tour support because it's like, oh, we got to go on tour again because the album's pushed back till October. Then by the time the album comes out, you get 9/11 right around it. And we're just out of funds essentially, as well as the other releases that are coming out on Roadrunner's list of great releases. You know, of course, Fear Factory is going to get more manpower from the staff than our band. That's, you know, just kind of stuttering out of the gate.
Yeah, I forgot, you know, that we spent so much money before the record even came out because they bought us a van and everything. And we did a lot of tours. And unfortunately, you know, all these tours were such small club tours. Like, we were spending so much money to not get much return in regards to possible fans, you know. Roadrunner didn't even mention a video until we were like, hey, can we have a music video? You know, like, you know, and we basically had to produce it ourselves. And
I think Dead Inside was our single. Because if you remember, they put promos out with Dead Inside on the Slayer tour. They put them out on their samplers. We didn't have a music budget video. Todd Bell was, hey, man, I'm trying to become a film dude. You guys are in San Francisco. And he did us a favor, is my memory of Split.
It was actually, Split was filmed at the warehouse where Mythbusters was filmed. Garrett Zunt, who I mentioned prior, who is, you know, one of the Strong Soul guys, he was interning there or doing something there. And he worked for, I don't remember if the show was even out yet or if it was the pilot of it, but it was the beginning of phases of that Mythbusters show. And that mustache dude, I can't remember his name, but it's his warehouse. He was so cool. He let us film he cleared it out and let us set up a music video set, and Todd filmed it. And I think we did it for like $2,000. It was just like, Roadrunner had no intentions on spending, you know, big money on us. And this is an era where a music video is, you know, they start at $50,000. You know, it's not like now where the equipment and the budgets are much, much cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did that. Yeah, that's like a piece of plexiglass and some water in his living room. Yeah, I mean, it's super low budget. And Todd was brand new. And, you know, this was a good opportunity for him as well, because now he's got a music video that's going to get played on international TV. It was a really cool experience. My worst rad memory is that's the day Lane Staley died, that we found out the world did anyway. He had died a week prior, but the day the world found out that Lane Staley passed was the day we were shooting that video. I remember that.
Rizzo has Stephen Carpenter somewhat involved. You alluded to earlier that you met him, so I didn't know, is he actually in the studio working on this song with you, or he just kind of was shooting ideas with you? How does that collaboration go down?
He came to the studio and brought his guitar, and it was all organic. There was nothing pre-planned, and it was just spur of the moment. I mean, we knew he was coming, but everything was organic and on the spot. The song was written and tracked all in one day.
I wish we had more time to write a song, because it was just kind of a get up and run and go, and it's like get it done with. And it was a total vibe situation where Stefan just started riffing out, and then it just went from there. Guys would just build upon what his ideas were. He definitely took the creative lead on the song, from what I remember, you know, because we wanted his influence, you know, on the song. So why not have him lead it? And I think he wanted that outlet that he wasn't getting in Deftones. He wanted more of the Meshuggah, Fear Factory, Chugga sound, which Deftones wasn't really incorporating back then. So it was a cool experience. I mean, I was freaking out inside because I was like, I got to act cool, but this dude is like in my favorite band ever and he wants to be on a song of ours. It's like, what the fuck, you know? I remember him inviting us to the Deftones show in Columbus around, it might've been after we tracked that song. Yeah, I think he recorded that with us before the way they went back on tour with White Pony. But anyways, we went to the show and brought us onto the bus and it was such a weird vibe where so this is a thing where I learned like later on in life that you don't do, like where a band member just brings three random dudes onto the bus and just kind of just sits them down, where like as a band member, you learn that, you know, that's your home. And so most band members don't just want rando showing up on the bus and hanging out that you don't know. And so not only does he just bring us on the bus with these, you know, veterans, touring veterans, you know, he brings us to the back lounge, which is like a private area of the bus. And Chino's, you know, hanging out back there with females. I don't know if they're his friends or whatever, but you know, he's hanging out with a female and it's like, I don't belong back here. It's really loud because they're cranking music. And I'm trying to say something to Chino, but my voice doesn't project very well. And he's just like, dude, what the fuck are you trying to say? And I felt so embarrassed. And I just like kind of cowered. And like, I just remember just being so embarrassed of that situation, meaning like a dude that, you know, I looked up to. And, you know, he wasn't, who knows if he meant to be a dick, but it was, you know, I could tell that he didn't want three random band dudes back there with Stefan, you know, who he wants to roll a joint and just shoot the shit, you know. In regards to Rizzo, I don't think I did too many samples on it because Stefan went so nuts with guitar pedals. He literally had like 30 guitar pedals on the ground. He would just sit there making noise with the freaking pedals and just strumming away and doing weird riffs. And they were so heavily affected and modulated that, you know, it sounded like a sample. So we're like, oh, perfect. You know, he took the lead on almost that whole thing.
Is it named after Mark Rizzo?
No.
The dog.
There's a studio named Rizzo. It was a little terrier. It was awesome.
And it kept shitting on the carpet.
Man.
That is one question I had about Taste My, because I know we talked about the song itself already, but why isn't it just called Taste My Tears? Why is Tears ellipsized?
Oh, man. I think because when you're like 22, you're trying to look more intelligent than you really are.
Okay.
Or mysterious. It's probably why. Like maybe it's Taste My Cock. What does he mean? What does he want to taste? Dude, that's just me trying to be creative. And
Same with spelling split with a space in it.
Yeah, exactly. Man, you see what I did there? That's creative.
split the word.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't necessarily have to comment on this, but I feel like Rizzo is like the blueprint and foundation for the entire Amira discography. Everything about it, the lyrics, the sound.
So this is interesting that you say that. And I'm a fan of Amir. I've met Frankie a few times and no beef, nothing but love. But their original guitarist, I met him when they were playing outside of Peabody's. And he came up to me and he said pretty much exactly what you just said.
Okay.
He said, Pass Out of Existence is his Bible, basically. Like that was his like biggest influence as a kid, all their riffs that he was writing for Amir. Like this is their first album, basically. And another band that blew me away that they were huge Pass Out fans was Whitechapel. Oh. So when we toured with Whitechapel, they had the 7 strings and tuned to our tuning as well. So it was always bizarre. You know, you hear them line checking and you're like, is he playing lumps? And you're like, wait, what? So that, you know, it took, because we were so hard on ourselves with this album and we had, for lack of better, you know, I don't want to utilize this term in the wrong way, but kind of PTSD from the whole thing. We're just ashamed, embarrassed, whatever you want to call it with that album. It was cool to see years later the impact it had on the deathcore scene, Suicide Silence, other huge fans of our band. Amir, Whitechapel, the list goes on and on. So that album, as much as we liked to shit on it, helped inspire, I should say, an entire genre of music, whether people like that genre or not.
Well, yeah, Chris alluded to it earlier that there are, you know, certainly death metal elements to Pass Out. They're not as pronounced, I guess would be the right word, but certainly your vocals have, you know, some death metal tinges to them in parts, and the riffs are all heavy and bouncy, which has never gone out of style, whether it has gone through different phases of how it's utilized. So I think it would be easy to say that that album was super influential, and it's coming out in the time where, you know, of course, nu metal is the biggest thing in the world. So you're in this canon of bands by default that everybody is kind of familiar with. You know, everybody knows that cover of Pass Out of Existence, whether you wish they did or not.
Sure. It's very cool. Like it helped, you know, as we age and everything, give a fresher perspective and a deeper appreciation when you see like what it actually. You're like, man, we inspired Whitechapel with that album. Well, shit, you know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I appreciate it more now than I did in like the middle of our career when, you know, being nu metal or whatever was so looked down on. And just also because, you know, I was so excited about the sound we had at that time, which was quite evolved from Pass Out. You know, I just naturally rejected Pass Out.
But I do think that's common that bands feel by default that their newer material is their best material. So they want to get away from the old stuff and being pigeonholed into it. So I think that's a natural thing. You guys have, it sounds like, a unique experience with just this album's creation and release. So that's certainly not helping your fondness for it at the time. But I think that that's normal for you to think that whatever. And I think it would be hard to say that Impossibility of Reason isn't a better album. It certainly, I think, technically is, but I like Pass Out of Existence more.
Yeah, that's sweet. Yeah, and that's what's cool too, is that I feel like with each evolution, we touch different metalheads and their wheelhouse different ways, right? And that is what our band is. We're a hybrid, so it's cool. We have, you know, fans that maybe appreciate nu metal sounds more, or maybe the deathcore sounds more. We got like people that love self-titled, where they just want that thrash, they want that headbanging metallic vibe, and you got dudes like me that are like, man, throw on the Infection, let's get stoned, man.
I have a feeling that if like Pass Out was produced or engineered differently, it would have completely changed the vibe of that record. It would have been more like Impossibility Reason. I think the mix and the guitar tones and the drum tones have a lot to do with why it sounds so much like that, the rest of that era at the time.
So the last three songs on the album, Force Life, Options, and Jade, all seem super, I guess, experimental, for lack of a better word. They're so much different than the rest of the album to me. Were those all newer songs that you guys wrote kind of later in the recording process, or no?
I don't recall. So Forced Life, I feel, was around before the studio. I feel like the death metal bridge part was developed in the studio. I remember kind of going over that with Rob and him writing that riff and being like, oh, that's the riff. Jade, a lot of that transpired in the studio. I don't remember it being that long in its original incarnation. Options, I feel like the music was written, but that's another one that I might have come up with at a later point. But I don't have much recollection other than one of my most fondest memories is of Jade. And it was when Stefan was in there and we were playing him Jade. And there's this cool part in the middle of the song where it, like, the whole fucking mix just goes into reverse. And I remember him, like, you know, Stone just like giving me the nod, like, that was cool. That was cool. Like, whoa, I got the nod. Like, that just, it felt so cool. Like, giving that nod of approval from your idol, musician idol. So that's really the only memories I have of it, where was Rob coming up with the death metal riff. I remember tracking the vocals and being like happy with Options vocals, because it's all clean vocals and I did okay with it. I wasn't embarrassed with it. I share those same self-critical feelings and that Chris has. It's just like, you're like, it's a high school yearbook picture scenario, man. It really is. It's like, you might have this high school photo and like all the chicks are like, man, you look good. But you're like, I look like a fucking asshole. You know, that's kind of the same I guess, internal feeling. The only way you can describe when we were living it, right? That's how we felt inside.
Mud Rock definitely took you out of your comfort zone with the melodic vocals and pushed you to try some new stuff, which is good because it led to more experimentation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember you tracking that stuff and hearing it for the first time, you know, in a studio environment. It was really cool.
Yeah, Forced Life, I know you're saying that the biggest thing that you're taking from it is that kind of death metal bridge, but the thing that sticks out to me most for it is that super melodic chorus on the guitar. That's kind of what stuck out for me as far as, you know, and then going into Options that has that super clean singing that I was going to ask you if it even is you, because it sounds so different from your singing on the rest of the album. Well, to me, it sounds like Stephen Richard or Stephen Richards from Taproot is who I thought it was.
You know, I've heard Taproot a little bit and I've heard the Alice in Chains reference. So either one, you know, I was definitely more influenced by Lane, but trying my hardest not to sound like Lane, but I tried harder on Impossibility than I dialed it in more. But it was just interesting doing it. And Mud Rock was definitely influential in getting those performances out of me. I don't think though that I had the chops, you know, or the confidence in clean vocals until much later in our career. And when we had to go to perform some of those songs in the early stages of touring with Pass Out, you might not have heard Split and you might have loved that song, but I'm like, man, I don't sing it well. Like I hadn't developed my confidence yet, or I would be flat on stage, or we're playing these clubs, I can't hear myself. Severed's easier for me to pull off, right? Or something, or Forced Life is easier for me than Options or Taste My. So, but when you're in the studio, you can take, you know, 100 times to get it right, or get it close enough and they'll threaten auto-tune you or something. It's not until later where I'm like, man, I could sing Options today better than I ever sang it in the studio, right? But had Mud Rock not have persuaded me to do that, it would have never even led me to even try.
Around this time for Pass Out of Existence, you record a cover of Balls to the Wall for the ECW Anarchy Rocks album. And on top of that, Farm Club is bookended with Monday Night Raw. So are you guys into wrestling at all, or ever have any interactions with wrestlers where they're big fans of Chimera?
So I grew up as a huge wrestling fan. I am old school wrestler fan, like from the era where you're tuning into your UHF channel and you're seeing Sting come in, you know, with a bunch of fuzz through your television set. So I don't recall how the ECW thing happened.
So we were in, this was before Chimera was signed. Mark and I went to New York to meet with different managers, labels. I think this is when we went to Roadrunner first to meet Monty Connor. We went to, one of our stops was Concrete Management. They managed Linkin Park. They also did publishing for records as well. You know, he knew that at the time Chimera was charting on college radio and we had all this steam and, yeah, so we went to Concrete Management, kind of just hung out, talked to him, and he's like, hey, I'm putting out this ECW soundtrack. Do you guys want to be part of it? We're like, he's like, you'll be on a record with, you know, named off all these bands. And we're like, sure, of course, you know. But the catch was we had to cover Balls to the Wall. And we just went to Ben's studio, knocked it out. It was, you know, we didn't take ourselves seriously doing it. It was fun, but it was just you know, just one of those things that we did that, you know, I wouldn't say we're not proud of or proud of. It just happened. And it's a part of our history.
Yeah, it's interesting. The also that evening or that day when we were at Concrete, Linkin Park were there.
Oh, yeah.
And they were a brand new band. And they were just like another band in the same, like kind of in the same lounge area.
Yeah, that we're hanging out with. It was like a green room, yeah, with a bunch of...
Yeah. And they're like, hey, yeah, we're a brand new band. We're here. They were mixing their album and mastering it and Hybrid Theory. And they're like, check it out with us. And they were playing us their album. So we might have been one of the first people ever to hear Hybrid Theory. We have the only other wrestling connection we have, and I always forget about this, is it would have been the next album, but we had a B-side utilized for Backyard Wrestling video game.
Oh yeah.
That was interesting.
With the Insane Clown Posse.
Yes, exactly. But
I forgot about that.
Totally awesome to be a part of anything wrestling. I'm not sure if there were any other wrestling fans in the group, but I was for a long time as a kid.
I was a huge 80s wrestling fan. I mean, you know, Saturday night main events, you know, all that. I stuck to WWF growing up. I kind of fell off when the Rock era came on, but you know, my friend Kent Sinclair, so this is a guy who worked for us for a while. He's a Cleveland guy as well. He came to Vegas 8 years ago for this Japan wrestling thing. I don't remember what it was, but it was at a casino in Vegas, and he asked if I could go, and it was really cool. You know, I haven't been around that in a while, and it was all the biggest Japanese wrestlers were there.
What is something that you're most proud of about this album? I know there's a lot that you don't like about it, but what's your favorite thing about it?
Tell me what you don't like. Well, where do we begin? Here's the Roman scroll.
I'd say it was just the overall experience for me. Like, I can say that I got to live the actual music industry life back when it was booming and money was being thrown around. And I got to live the big experience of being flown to California to write and record a record. And then being indoctrinated to the Roadrunner family was huge because I looked up to him so much. So it wasn't so much like Pass Out, the music of Pass Out makes me proud. It's just the experience. And then hearing how other bands were influenced, you know, was huge. Innocence was the best part of it. And just not knowing what you're walking into.
My moment for that album is, as a musician and growing up and trying to be in bands, there was one moment I saw Machine Head play, and that was the first time I'd ever seen them. And I look after Davidian ended, I looked at my buddy. I'm like, I want to be in a fucking band like that one day. Then you fast forward to the day our album comes out. I'm in a car with the singer of Machine Head, and we're going to buy our albums together. Like, that was huge for me. And it was like kind of one of those peak moments. And then you go like a month later and we're on tour with Slayer, who's I'm into heavy metal because of Slayer. So like from that moment on, everything just went downhill with the band. So I reached my mountain and that was it. But no, for as a fan, like, I think that's my last moment I was ever a fan, you know what I mean? Cause after that, we're in the scene, we're in the mix, we're doing it with everybody. I learned that Kerry King isn't a guy on my poster. He's a guy that has a fucking lawnmower. I'm like, wait a minute, you have a fucking lawnmower? You don't just have pentagrams and swords and guitars. Like, wait, you care about trees and cutting your lawn? Oh, this is weird. You're a human being, right? So I think it was the last time I was still in that moment of like, true non-jaded musician fanboy, like, this is so exciting, it's the best moment of my life, we made it, we landed, this is it. We can't do that without that album, so I have to be proud of that. And it launches our career. It's just you know, we just wore the wrong sweater that day for the high school photo. Oh, I'm best and I see it that way. I'd rather be dead than have you stay, but you pretend that it's okay.
Right now is my time to die. 20 years of Pass Out of Existence, but it can't quite seem to disappear from my thoughts. Endless thanks to Mark and Chris for letting us in on the history of such an important album to me, and I know many of you, and whether they like it or not, to Kamira. If you want to keep up with Mark singing these songs, check out his Twitch channel at twitch.tv/Kamira_Mark. Follow today, subscribe tomorrow. While you're twitching, we'll be meeping here every week with another entry into the Roadrunner canon, so come on back, won't you? My name is Ryan Rainbow, this is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best I could come up with. Bye!
Meep Meep. Can you guys hear this if I do this?
Smoke weed every day!